Good morning, 743 here on the Mighty 690, and it is time for our chat with the folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. In studio with us, we have David Skronks and Jesse Gilmore. Good morning.
Good morning.
So starting out first here with Adavin, we have a topic to get to. But first of all, Adavin, I wanted to mention to you, since you are the diversified ag agent and everything, I was at, Atwoods in Bartlesville. And of course, I had to go by and look at the chicks.
Of course.
They were all gone. The only thing that was left was guineas.
I heard the same thing about the Orchlins here in Coffeyville. I had a friend that went there to get a couple chicks, and they were already sold out.
Yep, no one wants the guineas. It's sad. That's all they had.
I don't really blame them. Yeah, they're kind of cute. Guineas have their place.
They do, but they're cute as the little chicks. So no, it's people are, a lot of people are doing the chickens this year. So
yes,
we were talking about it before. How, well, it can be fun. I mean, do it if you want.
Yes, definitely.
But just be aware that you're probably not necessarily gonna be saving any money.
Yeah,
after
and
you have that get on that payment plan for that coop you just bought.
Right. Exactly. And then the monthly feed cost. But they are a lot of fun, and of course every spring chicks are really popular in all the farm stores. I did see a report yesterday that the egg prices have come down a little bit in the last couple of weeks, so
so no, that's a good stuff here. But hey, we are, you know, spring is in the air, and lambing season is pretty close, right?
Yeah, so it's pretty close for some producers, or it's already started for others. So just springtime, you know, of course we think of chicks, and of course those lambs and kids. And for anyone that's not familiar with goat terms, kids refer to a baby goat, so not human children in this case. And sometimes when you have kids and lambs, you'll have bottle kids or bottle lambs, which means you're raising them on a bottle instead of them nursing off their mom.
And what kind of causes, why does this happen, I guess?
Yeah, so it can be for a few different reasons. So if you're raising goats or occasionally even sheep for dairy production, some people will choose to pull the kids off of the does at birth or soon after birth, and that way they can begin milking that doe immediately for milk production. In some cases, it's also a management choice to help as a disease prevention method. Some common diseases in goats, such as CAE, is a common one. It is transferred through milk and other bodily fluids. So not allowing those kids to nurse helps prevent it, because unfortunately there's no treatment for it. But by pasteurizing the milk or heat treating the colostrum before it is fed to the kids, kills the virus and prevents it from spreading or passing on to that next generation. And then in some cases, unfortunately, or a doe or you will reject her kids or lambs and not let them nurse. And this could be because she's a first-time mom, isn't quite sure what's going on. And in some of those cases, you can get her to take the kids back if you have the time to work with her in those first couple of days. In other cases, sometimes, especially if they're out in the pasture, they'll have one and then walk off and have another one, so they don't realize they have two. And then, you have those cases of multiple births. Twins is really common in sheep and goats, as well as triplets and sometimes even quads. So when you get to triplets or above, sometimes you have a doe or ewe that is able to care for all three and has enough milk for all three kids or lambs. But oftentimes you don't. So a producer will choose to either supplemental feed one of the triplets or pull them off and raise them as a bottle kid or bottle lamb slowly. And that's to ensure they get enough milk to grow good.
Sure. Sure. Now, I know there is another trick where you can like roll them in the, you know, stuff from some of the other, the other ones.
So. Yeah. So sometimes, if you have two that have kitted or lambed pretty close to each other and one has a single and maybe one has a triplet, you can take one of those triplets and, like you mentioned, kind of rub it in the birthing fluid mm-hmm. and afterbirth, from the mom who had the single, and sometimes you can get that doe or ewe to adopt that other kid or lamb. And occasionally you get kind of lucky and you have a doe or a ewe that's really laid back and will kind of take to any kid or lamb. Mm. And those are always nice to have in the herd for instances when you do have one that needs to be bottle fed. You can just have her adopt it. So there's a couple options there. Sometimes if you really have time to work with them, even if you're not right there when that second one, kids, for example, to have that birthing fluid to rub over the kid to get her to adopt it that way. Occasionally, if you put her in a small pen and you can actually use Vicks vapor rub and put it on her nose and then put it on the kids, the top of their head and their rump, just kind of the base of the tail. Those are the two spots that does and ewes usually smell their kids and lambs to kind of identify them. And then all she'll smell is that Vicks vapor rub. So kind of by default, sometimes it works to trick them into thinking it's theirs.
I love it. That's great. So what should we know about caring for these bottle kids?
Yeah, so the first thing most important to know, and I've talked about colostrum before, is to make sure those kids and lambs get colostrum within the first 24 hours after birth. Ideally, those first 12 hours and even those first 6 hours after birth, for them to get the colostrum is best, because as time goes on, the absorption of those maternal antibodies in the colostrum that helps strengthen their immune system and that they really need to survive, them being able to absorb those decreases. And if you can't milk the mom out to get colostrum or let the kid or lamb nurse on the mom to get that colostrum, of course, you can sometimes get colostrum from a friend, another breeder that you know. And there's also colostrum replacers that you can buy. And I like keeping colostrum replacer on hand at all times. Just make sure you store it properly inside your house so it doesn't get too hot or too cold. And that way you'll always have some around if you need it. And goat and sheep colostrum. You know, sometimes the farm stores and co-ops will carry it, but if they don't and you're in a pinch, you can use cattle colostrum replacer for lambs and kids, and that will work as well. So that's the most important thing, and you want to make sure they get about 10% of their body weight in colostrum. And then after 24 hours old, they've had that colostrum, then you switch over to either milk or milk replacer. If you are raising dairy goats, then you're probably feeding them milk from one of your does that is producing, unless you're using all of that milk, of course, to make cheese or soap, produce other products. So switching them over to a good quality lamb or kid milk replacer is important, and then to have regular feedings. So if your schedule allows for it, you can do, you know, 3 times a day. Some people like every 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
I've also done it, you know, because of work schedules, morning and night.
Okay.
And that's fine as well. Some people are kind of leery of that because you think a baby, you typically think they need more often. Or more regular feedings, but a morning and an evening feeding works well. The important part is to keep them on a consistent schedule, not be changing that schedule around on them a lot, because they get used to feeding times and knowing when to expect it. And then also feeding them a regular amount of milk. You want them to get full, but you also don't want them to get over full.
Sure.
And bottle kids and lambs are kind of notorious for, especially once they've figured out that bottle, they will eat a lot more than they need. So you will have to cut them off.
Sure. And that comes from experience, you know, just trying to know how much they need and all that sort of thing. So, well, of course, a busy time and a time where, you know, a lot of folks are not going to be getting much rest, you know.
Yes.
But anything else we should know on this?
One other important reminder is that bottle kids and lambs, like I mentioned before, once they get the hang of that bottle, they really like to eat, which makes them prone to overeating.
Mm-hmm.
So if their mom has had that CDT or Covaxin 8 booster before she kidded or lambed, and they had, some colostrum from her, they got that passive immunity.
Oh, okay.
And that, vaccine helps prevent and protect against overeating diseases, which of course bottle kids and lambs are more prone to. If they haven't had colostrum from their mom, or maybe you got a bottle kid or lamb and you don't know kind of the history of it, there is a C and D antitoxin that you can give them that will give them more immediate protection against from overeating disease. And you can give that to them when they're young. And then once they get about a month old, the regular time for their first CDT or Covaxin 8 shot, then you can give them the actual shot that will help them build immunity to that.
Good deal. All right. Well, that's, of course, good information here. And if people do have questions for you on any of this, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
They can reach me by calling our independence office. That number is 620-331-2690.
Okay. Very good. Well, as a little preview, Jesse, what do you have coming up for us here in a few minutes?
Well, St. Patrick's Day is right around the corner, so we're going to be talking about Irish potatoes and how you can grow them in the garden.
Excellent. Well, that's going to be a good one. So look forward to learning more about that. And right now in Coffeyville, we're sitting at 38 degrees. We're looking at a high today in the mid-60s. It's going to be a breezy one. We do have a few fire weather concerns to counties west, so we'll keep track on that. And we'll be back before you know it here on KGGF. Good morning, 810 here on the Mighty 690, and we continue our chat with the folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District, David and Jesse back in studio. And Jesse, you said we do have an event coming up.
Yeah, so on March 25th, which is a Saturday from 1 to 4, we will be hosting a grafting workshop, hands-on grafting, in the Parsons area. So if anyone is interested in that, they need to call the Girard office in order to register. Seating is limited to 20 people, and it will cost $10 for materials. But if you are interested in learning how to do some woody plant grafting, that would be a good workshop to attend.
Excellent. We're looking forward to making some Frankenstein creations.
Yep. We are cutting down calorie pears, and we are grafting fruiting pears onto that, which is a 100% upgrade in my book.
Absolutely. That's wonderful. Well, hey, we are approaching St. Paddy's Day, and a lot of folks say that, well, that's the day when you should plant potatoes. So, you know, there's been some discussion on this and some of our other programming out of Cherokee County, and saying that, well, maybe temperature is a little more important than the calendar. But anyway, what do we have on the topic of Irish potatoes today?
Yeah, so obviously around St. Patrick's Day, people start thinking about planting potatoes. You want to plant around mid-March. St. Patrick's Day is a good rule of thumb, but you do need to kind of keep an eye on the temperature to make sure that it is not going to freeze. Freezing can cause a lot of problems in seed potatoes, mostly when it comes to decay and rot, especially if you're planting potatoes into heavier clay soils, which I would not recommend. In fact, usually, and this kind of sucks, I would not typically recommend planting potatoes for the most part, which is a problem because when I use Arma Community Gardens vegetable survey as an example of like the demand of different garden vegetables and fruits. And on their survey, potatoes came back as the most in-demand vegetable from the community garden, even
really?
More than tomatoes,
really?
Even more than any other fruit that you can grow.
That surprises me a little.
That was the one that most community residents said they would use the most of. And so people like potatoes, and rightfully so. Boil them, mash them, stick them in a stew. All those movie quotes that you can think of regarding potatoes. They're very true. They're a versatile vegetable in the kitchen. Unfortunately, they are pretty high maintenance when it comes to the type of soil they grow in and their management strategies. Potatoes are one of two plants that I ask about on our soil sample form when it comes to gardens, the other being blueberries. And for both potatoes and blueberries, you're going to be limited by the soil pH. So both blueberries and potatoes need an acidic soil that you are not going to find naturally without a lot of soil management. Potatoes need a pH between 5 and 6.5. Our soil pH averages somewhere around 7.2, 7.3. And that doesn't seem like a lot, but you need to keep in mind that pH is a logarithmic scale. And so a pH of 7 is going to have 10 times the amount of hydroxide ions that a pH of 6 is going to have. So a small decimal change in pH might not seem like a lot, but it is quite significant when it comes to soil acidity and also soil nutrient management. So a soil sample is an absolute must if you are interested in growing potatoes. And once you have the results, you can get an idea of how much elemental sulfur or acidifying fertilizers like urea you're going to need to add in order to bring your soil pH down to a more appropriate level for potato growth. Now, just because your soil is alkaline does not mean that potatoes will not grow. Plants in general are usually pretty tolerant of a wide range of conditions, but you're not going to be nearly as successful in potato production if you are starting behind the eight ball with more alkaline soils. So you do want to adjust the pH using elemental sulfur or other acidifiers if possible. The other thing that you need to keep in mind is, as I mentioned before, the soil texture of the location where you're trying to grow these potatoes. If they sit in standing water for too long, which can happen in the spring with our heavier rainfall and higher clay, you do introduce the potential for rot. So definitely a soil sample is called for. If you've never had a soil sample done before and a soil test for your pH, that is a good thing to know before committing to planting potatoes.
Sure. And you know, the funny thing is, so while it might be a little harder here, we've got 80 acres in my family up in northern Minnesota, and they up there we have sandy acidic soil, and it's perfect. So we grow potatoes and blueberries.
Yep.
Up there it's perfect for that, and literally we stick them in the ground in the spring and we don't come back. I mean, they're on their own, and they do pretty okay, you know. I mean, obviously we lose more than if we were there tending it, but you know, we just make up for that by planting more. But it is kind of a fun little hobby project up there.
Yeah, and I would say it's probably a little drier up there than it is.
Yes.
Down here.
Well, it can be kind of wet at times, but the soil still drains pretty darn well.
Yeah, because of the sand.
Yeah.
And the higher particle size, or yeah, larger particle size.
And it's rocky
size
too. You
know? Yep. And you don't have limestone as your parent material, so it's not naturally alkaline.
Yeah.
Because it's drier, because rainfall is not as extreme up there, I'm assuming.
Yeah,
that
you're not going to have a deluge sort of thing. It's going to rain consistently, but it's not like a huge, you know, downfall.
Pools and
yeah,
pools of
yeah,
standing water.
Exactly.
Yeah, so that is good for reducing disease potential in potatoes. Obviously, if you have ever learned about potato growing in Ireland, you've got the blight, which is a fungal disease that would be exacerbated by really extremely wet and prolonged wetness conditions, which you're not as likely to see in Minnesota as you are down here. Mm-hmm. I'm sure people who have lived through the last couple of springs know what I'm talking about. Yeah. Just weeks, well, a week at least of rain has happened for at least the past 2 years that I've been down here. So actually, to combat potential rot issues and standing water, you will want to build your potato plants up into a mound. And there's a couple reasons for doing that. One, by mounding the soil around the base of the plant, you will prevent potatoes from peeking out above the soil and getting exposed to sunlight. Because when potatoes are exposed to sunlight, they turn green, they start building up toxins. Not necessarily to the point where you are potentially going to die eating them, but they are going to make you sick and you will not want to eat them. Some people believe that when you go and buy potatoes at the grocery store, you can just cut them up and put them in the ground and they will grow. This is usually not going to be the case. A lot of times they will be treated in order to prevent sprouting. So you will need to look for designated seed potatoes instead of just going to the grocery store to find them.
Are there any varieties that work better around here?
So there are some varieties that are recommended by K-State. It all kind of depends on what you're looking for as far as using them in the kitchen. So some are going to be better for baking, some are going to be better for mashing, boiling, and some will have a good all-purpose use for whatever. Your three main categories of seed potatoes that you're going to find are going to be white-skinned varieties, red-skinned varieties, and russet-skinned varieties. White-skinned, in general, are going to be better for baking and mashing, while red-skinned varieties are going to be better for boiling. And russet can be both. So some of the varieties that you're going to want to look for white-skinned varieties are Superior, Norchip, Irish Cobbler, or Kennebec. For red-skinned varieties, you want LaRouge, Lesota, Norland, or Red Pontiac. And then for russet, you want Norgold Russet or Norcota. All of those are varieties that have been tried and researched in Kansas and have been proven to work well. It is also likely, although I don't have the I don't have the statistics right in front of me, that these varieties will tolerate our soils better. I don't know exactly what type of soil management was done on the soil that these potato varieties were tested in, but I imagine that because we were starting with more alkaline soil, that they are more productive in alkaline soil.
Well, and obviously this is not something that we really need to talk about until the fall, but while it's on my mind, what is the thought on washing potatoes after you've harvested them? What's going to make them keep longest?
So for harvesting, you've got two timings for harvesting. You've got pre-summer and you've got end of fall. For pre-summer harvesting, you need to keep them in a cool place, 55 to 60 degrees, preferably lower moisture, which you're not typically going to experience a ton of, but the less moisture that you can store them in, like lower humidity in the air, the lower likelihood of sprouting mm-hmm. in storage. One thing that also has been researched recently is the coating of potatoes in peppermint oil. And the peppermint oil will volatilize off of the potatoes, but it will prevent sprouting in storage, and it does not affect the flavor. You could also use spearmint oil, but it is more likely to impact the flavor of potatoes. So
spearmint potatoes.
Yeah, peppermint oil is the way to go if you want potato-flavored potatoes. But you do 55 to 60, or if you're harvesting in the fall, 35 to 40 degree storage area. You don't want to store potatoes in an area that will freeze. That will lower the shelf, the lifespan in harvesting and storage quite considerably.
Okay. Now, what about, I've heard of people trying this, growing on a small scale, obviously, potatoes in like some sort of trash can, a container, a big drum. Any thoughts on doing that?
Yeah, actually, that would be much easier as far as management of soil goes, because usually it kind of depends on where you're getting your soil or your potting media from. If you're just bringing topsoil from, you know, out in pasture or out in the field, it is still going to be alkaline. You are still going to need to adjust the pH. Obviously, you're going to need to apply less elemental sulfur or incorporate peat moss as an organic matter source into the soil. But if you can get neutral or even slightly acidic topsoil or potting media, potting media might be a little bit of a drawback because it naturally does not have any nutrients in it when it is bagged, as opposed to soil, which does have some nutrients no matter where you're getting it from. But potting media is also lighter. Water will not sit in there as long. There's some benefits and drawbacks to doing it in containers, but one good way to really increase the potential benefit of growing in containers is making sure you have the right media in the container.
Now, planting depth, and should the eye be up or down, or does it matter?
So for planting depth, you are going to want to plant... before planting depth, we should talk about seed potatoes.
Okay, yeah.
So seed potatoes have one of two grades from the USDA, depending on where you get them from. You want blue label, not red label. Red label is grade number two. Usually red label will be cheaper. There's not so much of a difference. It kind of depends on, you know, if you want to start with the best quality seed potatoes, usually you're going to have a more productive growing season. But seed potatoes are sold by the pound. You want to cut them up into pieces that are about 1.5 ounces and have at least one eye. There's going to be around 8 to 10 seeds per pound of seed potato. So you do want to plant them around 3 feet apart per row. And you want to cut them up and store them in an area around 65 to 70 degrees for about 5 to 7 days before planting them. And the reason for that is because they will actually scab up and form a protective coat around the seed that will prevent damage from late frosts or freezes. So it's basically curing the seed. And... by doing that, you are less likely to have total crop failure should we get a late frost. And our average last frost date is around April 15th. So about half of the time we're going to get a frost or freeze after April 15th, and about half of the time we won't. So that is a good rule of thumb. But because potatoes set their tubers when the plant is around 6 inches tall and the temperature is cooler, now is around the time to be preparing the seed potatoes for planting. As far as planting depth goes, 3 to 4 inches deep is probably about good. When you have them start sprouting, you want to remove about the top 2 inches of soil, leaving only about 2 inches left. But do keep in mind that you will need to go out and check to make sure that potatoes are not peeking out above the soil. Most of the growth of the potatoes will come when the plant is about 6 to 8 inches tall. The potatoes, there's a common misconception that potatoes will do most of their growing around the time the plant flowers. That's actually not the case. They set their tubers much earlier.
Okay.
But the tubers will continually set starch throughout the growing season. So one insect that I've dealt with the times that I did have to deal with them, they were a pain in the butt, are Colorado potato beetles. And I have not heard of them being down here. They are more up in the Kansas City area. But Colorado potato beetles are the one crop insect with potatoes that I would watch out for, because if they are present, they will totally defoliate the plant. Colorado potato beetles, depending on how warm the winter is, They could emerge early, they could emerge late. If they emerge early, you're likely to have much smaller potatoes, because once the plant's defoliated, then they can't really set more starches because they can't go through the photosynthesis. If we get a late frost or freeze that kills off most of the emerged beetles, you're going to be typically fine. And the timing of when that defoliation happens will go a long way towards determining how impactful they're going to be on your yield.
Is there a treatment for the potato beetle?
There are some treatments. In most cases, I would not actually say it's necessary because mm-hmm. of the timing is so important. Sure. And getting your potatoes in the ground early enough will go a long way towards minimizing the impact of the beetle.
Gotcha.
Because the sooner you can set the tubers and can develop a lot of that early season growth, the less impactful any future defoliation will be.
Gotcha.
Obviously, you do want to keep it to a minimum, but in most cases, the cost of the insecticide is not going to warrant the marginal benefit you're going to get from extra potato growth.
Good deal. Well, anything else we should know?
I would honestly, if you are interested in growing a root crop like potatoes but don't want to deal with soil management, I would recommend sweet potatoes over Irish potatoes every time.
And so those are with the slips, usually you buy those.
Yep, yep. They are going to be much less management heavy than Irish potatoes will. They tolerate a much wider range of soil pH. And as far as nutrient density goes in the part of the plant that you eat, you can't get much better than sweet potatoes for garden vegetables that do well here. Obviously, people like potatoes. They use them more in the kitchen, and so they're always going to be more popular as a garden vegetable, but for less headaches, sweet potatoes every time. So if you are interested in Irish potatoes or sweet potatoes, we do have publications on both, and you can call our office, and I can get those publications sent your way if you want that info.
Good deal. And how can we do that?
You can call the Girard office at 620-724-8233.
Okay. Well, Jesse Adavin, appreciate you coming on here, and always informative as a potato quote-unquote producer. I learned a lot today. So
thanks for having us.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I look forward to chatting again soon.
Sounds good.
All right, and hey, we got an early bird edition of Open Line on the way here on the Mighty 690.